Yes, it's called Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. I'm with Peter Ames Carlin, the author. Peter, thanks for being with us. And congratulations. I see where it has been named People Magazine's Book of the Week.
Yeah, well, that was very sweet of them. But thank you for that, too.
Yeah. Going back towards the beginning, a lot of people, if not most, know that Simon and Garfunkel at one point were Tom and Jerry. And they were high schoolers at the time and cut a record or two. One of them was kind of successful, especially on the East Coast. And I had to laugh because I recall the Dick Clark payola scandal back in the 50s and the 60s. And they were booked on the Dick Clark Show for what I thought was a pretty good fee, $176 for an appearance back in 1957, 1958 or so?
Mm-hmm. Thanksgiving of 1957, right before Thanksgiving. It was this huge break for them because everybody was into American Bandstand back in those days. It was the American Idol of its time, you know, only I think way more powerful because there wasn't a lot of media out there. So everything that ended up on the TV was enormous. And they got to play on the same show with Jerry Lee Lewis and some other folks. And the union rules for TV performers was that the basic union rate was $176 for an appearance. But the rule with American Bandstand was that for certain artists, you had to immediately sign the check over to Dick Clark. So he was profiting on both ends, you know.
I can't
which hardly seems fair, but there you go.
I can't hardly see the killer, Jerry Lee Lewis, signing the check back over to Dick Clark.
Well, I think Jerry Lee Lewis got to keep his money, yeah, the star that he was. But
do you recall
for youngsters just coming up, pay for play.
Do you recall how that Dick Clark payola scandal ended? I was going to look it up, and I hadn't had a chance. I don't think he was charged with anything, but it was a pretty big scandal back then.
Well, if he wasn't going to be charged, I think it was because he worked out a deal where he was going to sell off his interest in the publishing company that he owned and some other kind of related businesses. So that was against the law back in those days. So that's how it ended. It was Alan Freed, the DJ in New York, who was doing the same thing on,
right,
I believe, a smaller scale, who ended up getting busted.
There are a couple of great connections that I wasn't at all aware of, one of them being Al Kooper and his connection with the Bridge Over Troubled Water, and another one, a woman named Heidi Berg, and her lending Paul a cassette. Could you tell us about, first off, the Al Kooper connection?
Well, Al Kooper, who, you know, I think is best known these days for having played the organ on Like a Rolling Stone, mm-hmm, Dylan song, and being part of Dylan's inner circle in those early electric days, was a neighbor of Paul and Artie's. They didn't know it, but they met him, I think, he was in a New Jersey band that had a hit when they had a hit, so they would bump into each other on the sock hop circuit around New York City in the Northeast. And they became buddies, Paul and Art and Al Kooper became buddies as teenagers. So Paul would actually get Al Kooper to play lead guitar when he was sitting in with his dad's dance band doing, you know, twist numbers, mm-hmm, you know, for 10 minutes each hour while the rest of the band took a break. So that connection goes back a long, long time. And when he wrote Bridge Over Troubled Water, it was sort of as a result of having borrowed a gospel record from Al Kooper and being completely drawn into it. And so, yeah, so it's a very interesting and little-known connection between,
yeah,
those two guys.
And then Heidi Berg lends him a cassette. What happened then?
Well, she was a little-known musician who I think had been working on the Saturday Night Live band, and then when Lorne Michaels started a sort of a second primetime show called The New Show in 1983, she was his music director. The show got canceled very quickly, unfortunately, and when she had nothing to do, I guess Paul needed an assistant or something, and she started working with him. And he was going to help her with her music career and all this stuff. And she played him a cassette of the South African pop music, and he fell in love with it as she had fallen in love with it when she first heard it. She had hoped to get that sound on this record she thought she would be working on with Paul, but Paul eventually sort of took up the ball himself and went to South Africa and started working on Graceland,
which was kind of successful.
It was kind of enormously, hugely,
yeah,
world-changingly successful.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but also controversial for,
yeah,
a whole lot of reasons.
Yep, it certainly was. So Paul took the ball and ran with that and kind of left Heidi hanging. Paul also, and throughout this book, it's kind of a feeling I had even prior to reading the book, he's not the nicest guy in the world. When he was in London, Ralph McTell called him something along the lines of a miserable little fella. He kind of screwed over Los Lobos over their music, and he claimed the credit for it. He did the same with Martin Carthy and Scarborough Fair and claimed the credit for that arrangement as well. Is that the picture you get, at least from time to time, with Paul Simon?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, yes, Paul has made some tough deals with people, and the Los Lobos thing about the song that they recorded with him for the Graceland record is very much an open book and a controversy and something that people still talk about. But on the other hand, Paul is capable of enormous generosity as well. And there are a lot of people, for all the people who get red-faced and angry talking about Paul and the effect he had on their lives and their careers, there are other people who get teary-eyed talking about the great kindnesses he's done for them. I mean, he's directly responsible for building careers for artists ranging from the jazz trumpeter Chris Botti to the Roaches, the great singing group that were, you know, so successful in the 80s. And he was working with them in the early 70s and helping sort of finance the start of their career. When he first got a record advance to make a solo record in England in the mid-60s before Simon and Garfunkel took off, he took like half of his advance and turned around and spent it on a songwriter he loved named Jackson C. Frank. And he thought Jackson should have a bigger career, so he invested his money to record this record and got Jackson Frank a record deal, and you know, a lot of great music came out of that. So yeah, it goes both ways, but with all of us, we're all sort of shot through with shades of gray in our behavior. You know, you want to be your best self, but sometimes you're just not, you know?
Good point. Chatting with Peter Ames Carlin, Peter's brand new book, and it's a good one. It's called Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. What about the Bob Dylan connection? They kind of went back and forth and back and forth. He liked Dylan, he didn't like Dylan, or at least his music or what he stood for. But they ended up, if I remember right, touring and playing some minor league ballparks together very recently, maybe in the 90s or so.
Yeah, it was in 1999. It was a big tour. It got a lot of attention. That, you know, they did a few songs together. But back in the 60s, Dylan, when his first record came out, it was hugely influential on Paul and his writing, as, you know, as Dylan was on so many people back in those days. And so he changed his style a little bit and, you know, still was very much his own writer, his own self. But people immediately compared him and Dylan in ways that Paul kind of got the short end of the stick in those direct comparisons. And he began to resent that very much. And there's one song, that Simon and Garfunkel tune, A Simple Desultory Philippic, which is basically the cruelest satire of Dylan ever, you know, that Paul wrote. And, you know, so you can hear that resentment boiling. And the interesting thing was, I think things have cooled off between them, you know, and they're probably a lot more friendly than anything else. But when Paul turned 75 the other week, it just happened to be the same day that the announcement came that Bob Dylan had been awarded a Nobel Prize for literature. So you have to wonder whether that cast a small shadow over Paul's big birthday. I mean, I hope it didn't, but who knows?
Well, listen, it's been great chatting with you. I'm told we have to go. Congratulations once again. It's a great read. It's called Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon, with my guest Peter Ames Carlin. Peter, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And for Around Cincinnati, I'm Brian O'Donnell. Everybody sees the wind blow. I'm going to Graceland, Memphis, Tennessee. Graceland. Poor boys and pilgrims with families, and we are going to Graceland. And my traveling companions are ghosts and empty sockets. I'm looking at ghosts and empties. But I've reason to believe we all will be received in Graceland. There is a girl in New York City who calls herself a human trampoline. And sometimes when I'm falling, flying, tumbling in turmoil, I say, whoa, so this is what she means. She means we're bouncing into Graceland. And I see losing love is like a window in your heart. Well, everybody sees you're blown. Everybody feels the wind blow. Ooh, in Graceland, I'm going to Graceland. For reasons I cannot explain, there's some part of
every love, every ending. Or maybe there's no obligations now. Maybe I'm a reason to believe we all will.